Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the study of the early Christian movement and its implications for the church today. To open our series, we have Michael, our resident ephesiologist. I'm Andrew Johnson in Houston, Texas, and today we are so honored to be joined by Brad Briscoe, Dr. Brad Briscoe. We'll lead with that. He is the director of multiplication strategies for the Sin Network, holding a doctorate in the area of missional ecclesiology. His doctoral thesis was on assisting existing congregations in transitioning to a missional direction. He is the co-author of Missional Essentials, a 12-week small group study guide, The Missional Quest, Becoming a Church of the Long Run, which I think is a great title. Well done. Next Door as It Is in Heaven, Rethink, and Co-Vocational Church Planting. If you are excited by all he brings today, you can catch up with his blogs as he blogs regularly at missionalchurchnetwork.com. Brad, it is an honor to have you with us.
Thanks, Andrew. Good to see you and Michael both.
Yeah, good to have you on the podcast. We have intersected in so many ways over the past couple of years, and I'm glad that we have this dedicated space now to pick your brain for the podcast and in this series on what does Jesus look like where you are. And so I'm excited that we get to launch this with you, Brad.
Looking forward to the conversation. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so before we launch long and excitedly into co-vocational things and what that looks like in a particular context, Brad, what are three things that you would say your friends know about you that you could like share with us on the podcast so that people who haven't interacted with you or your material might get to know you a little bit more and understand you and why we have asked you to be on the show?
Well, a couple of things, maybe. I've worked for what's called the North American Mission Board, as you said, Andrew. There's a team I lead called Multiplication Strategies, which is really kind of a research and development team. So we do anything that's kind of outside the prevailing model of church box. But I've worked for that group for 25 years now. Probably 17 of those years, I was what was called a church planting catalyst in Kansas City, which just meant I helped to recruit and train and resource and coach church planters. But then 5 years ago, we moved to the Gulf side of Florida and a couple of different reasons. One, I'm old and I like warm weather and the water. But secondly, there's a church here called the Tampa Underground. I wanted to be closer to what they're doing because I just think it's a great picture or example of what I call a decentralized network of microchurches. So we wanted to be in a position to kind of tell their story back into the tribe that I work for. So that's one thing. A second thing, I guess, even though I am old, I still have a 15-year-old daughter that lives with us here in Florida that's in high school. And I just love, man, I love being outside, love the warm weather. I don't love the hurricanes. I mean, we've had conversations about it already, but just 2 months ago, we experienced two major, major hurricanes within 10 days. The first one was huge storm surge. We had 8 feet of water that just covered our city. Wow. And for 7 or 8 hours. And then 10 days later, we had another hurricane that had 120 mile an hour winds. So the first one was all about water and the second one was all about wind. So we're just getting back, trying to get back to normal just one day at a time.
Oh my goodness.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. Well, thank you for thank you for joining us and stepping away from all the recovery efforts and all the things. Maybe this is a distraction, right? This is just distraction from all the other things that you're a part of.
Brad, I have to say, I mean, we are so sympathetic with what's happening down there, but so grateful for how the church is responding. And I know you've seen that there, much more to do, but maybe can you just speak a little bit about how the church has been responding to the needs in the community?
Yeah, no, I think the church definitely has been responding. I tell you, for me, probably just as important or as encouraging as that is just the neighborhood. I mean, really, it's been absolutely incredible. We already had just amazing relationships with all of our neighbors, and we work really hard at cultivating those relationships and getting to know everybody you know, in a kind of a several block radius of where we live. But in the midst of the hurricane, something completely different happened. I mean, there was just a sense of, you know, use Alan Hirsch, it's not coined by Alan, but, you know, the word communitas. We really experienced that there was a sense of community that was deepened because everybody was engaged in this same kind of mission of seeing our city restored. And it's just brought about relational connections and a depth of our relationships that just wouldn't have happened otherwise. So we've been just super encouraged by all of that, the connections and the opportunities we've had to just try to be a blessing to people. And it's been super encouraging in the midst of all the kind of the struggles and the trials.
Yeah, neat. That's neat. Well, just by word of testimony, Brad, I guess it's been a couple years ago now that you and I recorded a session on co-vocational ministry, co-vocational church planting. And I have used that continuously over the past 4 years in a church planting course that I teach at a seminary in Seoul, South Korea. And the students love it. I mean, part of their goal in that class is to develop a church planting philosophy. And I cannot tell you how many of those philosophies revolve around co-vocational work. And so just by way of encouragement to you, your passion for co-vocational church planting is being shared with others around the world. So thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, no, that's very encouraging for sure.
Well, let's look at this as the intro. So our series right now, we are hoping to talk with practitioners and people who are experiencing unique forms of ministry or when I say just different, maybe even what we expect or experience in the expected Sunday morning centric model. But I think as a starter, it would be good, like a slingshot, to kind of pull it back a little bit to gain some power. Why should we do something such as co-vocational ministry? If things are already and have existed in this Sunday morning centric model, and it's worked so well, pause for dramatic effect. it's worked so well. Why would we even look to something like co-vocational ministry strategies? So Brad, if you would, you know, be willing to pull back that slingshot, go, what are some of those theological underpinnings for you?
Well, as it relates to co-vocational ministry, and one thing maybe I might do, Andrew, is just make a distinction, because if someone's heard, that's the first time they've heard that word, co-vocational.
Yes, thank you.
To make a little distinction between bivocational and co-vocational. When I moved into this new role, really giving specific emphasis to bivocational church planting, I knew one of the things that I wanted to be about is trying to change what I would call the biased narrative around bivocationalism. And what I mean by that is most people, not everybody, but most people kind of have a negative perspective towards bivocationalism or bivocational pastoring or church planting. You know, they just see it as like you're bifurcating, you're compartmentalizing, you know, you do work over here so you can do mission and ministry over here. And it's just kind of has a negative connotation to it. Well, I knew I wanted to try to change that biased narrative. And I think there's different ways of going about it. But one of the things that I felt like we needed to do is we needed to expand the language. So not necessarily change it, but we needed to expand it. Mm-hmm. So think about that word bivocational. So again, I just use the word bifurcate. I think that's what we do too often is when we hear the word bivocational, we bifurcate, you know, we take one thing and we divide it into two parts or we compartmentalize. And I don't think that's very helpful. So we started playing around with some different words several years ago, and we started using this word co-vocational. So think about that word for a minute, co-vocational. Co, C-O, comes from the Latin prefix com, C-O-M, which means to have in common. So think of words like co-pilot, co-laborer, companion. It's really about bringing two things together. I'd like to say it's about leveraging two things together. Mm-hmm. So I still use the language of both bivocational and co-vocational, but here's the nuance, kind of the distinction for me. A bivocational church planter is someone that has a part-time job in the marketplace that they see as temporary. So in other words, their hope or their dream or aspiration is that the church will grow large enough that they can leave their part-time job and focus full-time on the church. And that's the way most church planters today in North America, that's how they look at it, is that they're going to plant a church. They have to have a part-time job to kind of make ends meet. But their goal is to eventually see the church grow large enough that they can leave and focus full-time on the church. And I would say nothing wrong with that. But co-vocational, the difference is a co-vocational church planter is someone that has a job in the marketplace that they never intend to leave. So in other words, they know God has called or wired them to be an architect or an engineer or a school teacher or a web designer. And at the same time, they feel like they're called to start something. So I want to help a co-vocational church planter recognize they don't have to choose, that we want to bring alignment between what God's called them to do in the marketplace and starting something. So that's the first place I would start. It's just make that distinction. One's not better than the other, but I'm convinced in a rapidly, rapidly increasing missionary context that all of us live now, we have to think differently about church planting. And I just think there are enormous missiological benefits and enormous financial benefits of planting as a bivocational or a co-vocational church planter. So we can come back and dig into this a little bit. Let me just hit those real quick. So missiologically, what I mean by that, and this is, you know, this isn't rocket science here, but if you have a job in the marketplace, you have access to a mission field you wouldn't have otherwise. Mm-hmm. So that's a big piece. Secondly, missiologically, is I think it gives you great respectability or street cred both inside the church and outside the church when you have a job in the marketplace. People in the church, they appreciate that you can relate to what they go through Monday through Friday. But then outside the church, I just think it's a great place to start when you're building relationships with people in your neighborhood or workplace or social spaces, that you can start off a conversation by what you do in the marketplace rather than saying, well, I'm a church planter or I'm a pastor, because there's a lot of context. That's just a conversation killer right there. You know, like, it stops when you share that you're a pastor. But then financially, I think there are enormous financial benefits. I like to say there's financial benefits to the church planter. So what I mean by that is when the primary support for the planter is coming from the marketplace, there's just less financial strain on the church planter and the church planter's family, especially when that marketplace calling or job provides benefits like insurance, vacation, retirement, things like that. Secondly, I think there's enormous financial benefits for the church plant. So again, it's just a kind of a no-brainer, but when the primary support for the planter is coming from the marketplace, there's just more resources available for mission and ministry for the church. Mm-hmm. And then lastly, I would say there's greater financial benefits or stability for the church planting entity. So depending on what denomination you're a part of, you know, they have different language association or general conference or state convention or national entity, but there's not enough money to plant all the churches that we need to plant with fully funded planters. So the only way we're going to see a real church planting movement is to plant churches with bivocational and co-vocational church planters. So that's just a little bit. We could dig into all of it more, but I just think in a missionary context, again, where we all live, we need to plant churches with planters and pastors that think more like a missionary and less like a pastor that's starting a Sunday morning worship service. So I say all the time, look, I'm not anti-gathering. We are a worshiping, gathering community. But I think today we just can't start there. We need to start with missionary behaviors and activities and get to the Sunday gathering. But we just can't start with the Sunday gathering. So that was a lot.
Yeah, that was good, too. And it prompts several questions, one of which that I want to dive into, but not maybe the first one, but the one that is flowing through my head at the moment is, how do we prepare people for that? But secondly, what's the reality? And this is the one I'd like for you, if you could address at this moment, what's the reality today? I mean, if you think about bivocational, co-vocational, what percentage of people are we talking about in the context of North America, maybe limited to the United States? How many people are involved in this at the moment?
Yeah, that's a great question, Michael. It's hard to answer because different denominations define bivocational or co-vocational differently. But I would say kind of across denominational lines, it's somewhere between 60 and 80% of our current pastors are bivocational on some level. Now, within our church planning network that I work for, it's interesting. We used to have like two categories. We would have fully funded planters and bivocational planters. And the numbers, though, a lot of times they would look at the numbers at the end of the year, and the number of bivocational planters was really small. Well, the reality is like 80% of our planters and our non-English speaking planters is nearly 100% were bivocational. Right. They just didn't call themselves bivocational because that meant they would receive less money for the church planting entity. Huh. So, but almost every church planter has a side hustle of some sort. So it's just really hard to define because, you know, someone that's working a 10-hour side hustle to make a little bit of income, do we consider them bivocational? If so, then of course that percentage is much higher. But I would say easily it's somewhere between 60 and 80%. And again, in a lot of different ethnic church planting contexts, it's nearly 100%.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing to think that it's that high. I mean, you know, we are so ingrained with a traditional model, and beginning at the seminary, where the seminary is preparing a pastor. The seminarian graduates, expects to go to a church and receive a calling in that church and then be paid. What you're saying is that is not the norm. That's the hope of a lot of seminarians, but the norm is, the reality is something very different.
Yeah, very different. And that's part of the kind of that biased narrative, is that, yeah, we just had too many leaders going to seminary thinking they were going to get out and get a full-time job and saying, you know, and in a church. And I also see it with church planters all the time. We have so many planters that will plant and they're fully funded for 2 years, maybe 3 years, but, you know, 18 months in, 2 years in, they see that the funding is going to dry up. So then they feel like a failure when they have to become bivocational. Where if we would have started them off that way, it just complete game changer. You know, they see the missiological and financial benefits of actually starting as a bivocational or co-vocational planter, and then it's just the norm. Rather than 2 years in, you know, they thought that they could, you know, grow the church large enough and quick enough or fast enough that then they could become full time. But like you just said, Michael, that nowadays it's just a rarity. It just is.
Well, it also strikes me, the one part, I think, I mean, it seems obvious to me, we just haven't touched on it. It's also the being co-vocational as a pastor planter means that the work of ministry is also spread out wider. There are more people who are within the church who are going to be assisting in leadership. They are going to take ownership of it. If the pastor is the full-time, fully funded person, a whole lot of people love coming to church just to watch him do his thing and say, okay, what are you going to do for me? What does the church do for me? And by the church, I mean still you. But a co-vocational pastor literally doesn't have the bandwidth to even step to the fore and say, yeah, I'm going to do all these things. No, I can't do all these things. And so now you're asking, what is it? What's the scope of ministry that we believe God is calling us to as a church? Okay, I'll play my part here. So who else is stepping up? And it really, I think, it helps train a healthy model of people being involved as the church, being the church where God has called them to.
Yeah, I agree, Andrew. It's actually, that's a third benefit I didn't mention earlier. I talked about missiological benefits, financial benefits, and the third one is shared leadership. And that's exactly right. And I see the shared leadership in two ways. One is co-vocational church planter, you have to plant with a team. Like everybody that's involved in church planting, they would always say you should plant with a team. But if you're co-vocational, there's no other option. Like there is no possible way you can work 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week in the marketplace and plant a church without a fully functioning church planting team. But then secondly, to what you just said, it really activates the priesthood of all believers out of necessity. Like nobody sits on the bench, like everybody has to play. So there's a church planting team component, but there's also like a body of Christ component that we have to recognize, understand, and activate all the people of God to engage in mission when you're co-vocational. So I actually see that as a benefit because it forces that conversation rather than some, you know, it kind of deprofessionalizes and it kind of diminishes that clergy laity divide, which of course is a good thing for the body of Christ.
Yeah. Wow. So let me provide then the second reference to Alan Hirsch. Alan being, you know, the leading voice with 5Q and looking at that apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, teacher, when just kind of, again, that benefit pointing to the priesthood of all believers, shared leadership. It also is, I think, ingrained at go, like I am only part. God has gifted me in one way, but for this to carry forward and for his mission to be accomplished, the rest of the gifts are going to have to step up. Right. We can't have people on the sidelines.
Yeah, and I use APES a lot around church planting teams. I mean, it's actually the, when I talk about team dynamics, we take church planters through APES so they understand how they're wired, what voice or gift is missing on your team, and then how are you going to ensure that you're listening to all of the voices from all of those giftings. And then also, like you just said, Andrew, it's also crucial conversation to have then as it relates to the body, because we want the entire body to recognize how they're gifted and then what role do they play in activating the body of Christ into mission. So yeah, APES is a crucial component in both of those scenarios.
It's tempting for us to be thinking about this as a new strategy in church planting, but it isn't, is it?
Yeah, that's a great, there are two things you just said, Michael, I think are important. One is to use the word strategy, because a lot of times when people hear Bivo or Covo, they think model, they think small. And I like to say, this isn't about a model, it's about a strategy. This is a missiological and financial strategy. I know churches, you know, network of microchurches that are led by Bivo Covo leaders. I also know very kind of traditional attractional churches that are led by Bivo Covo leaders. So this isn't about a model, it's about a strategy. But then secondly, what you just said, okay, now I just thought
not something new.
Oh yeah. Oh, heavens no. I mean, like this is, yeah. In fact, I think we have to be careful as white Americans to think that like, oh, well, this is a conversation we need to bring to the larger body of Christ. It's like, no, we need to learn from non-English, non-white speaking or non-white, non-English speaking churches, because this is the norm. And it has been forever to be bivocational or co-vocational. Jokingly, sometimes I'll have someone say they're tri-vocational, like, you know, they have multiple jobs in the marketplace. So, and also around the world, right? I mean, it's really like, I love what you just said, Michael. It's really, it's almost like, this is a generalization, probably isn't completely fair, but it's like, it's a recalibration for American evangelicalism that has kind of bought into the, you know, launch large, attractional model of church. That's where we're trying to say, no, there. And again, this is a both and, it's not an either or, but it's like, it's kind of that way of thinking about ecclesiology that we want to challenge or push back on a little bit, with co-vocational strategies. So now you're absolutely right. This isn't something new. But it might be new for kind of the American prevailing model of church, not new, of course, but we need, there's a recalibration, I guess, that needs to take place.
Well, it's a little bit like the consumerism has a way of just eating up all the air and space around it. And so sometimes when you're in the midst of it, it's all you know. So there is a little bit of grace in, you know, you don't know what you don't know. Right. But to be able to think about these things, to be encouraged and step out of that bubble, you see that there are a whole lot of people with open arms and saying, welcome to the club. We're glad you're here. We're glad that you're able to see what God has already been using and where he has already been working for a very long time. Let's join in together. Off of what I just accidentally said, but I'm going to use it as a transition, and I want to transition back to something you said. You kept talking about missionary opportunities. You're talking about all of the opportunities that are around a church or that a church desires to step into. How do you feel, or why do you feel, that there are increasing missionary opportunities around us that we need to then take on the strategies so as to solve?
Well, yeah, gosh, there's several different directions we could kind of go there. I think first off, it's helpful to recognize, or it's helpful to help people in our churches recognize that there are significant cultural shifts that have been taking place for some time now. I mean, and sometimes if, you know, if someone's kind of living in a Christian bubble of sorts, they might want to push back on this, but the reality is every single indicator you look at to judge church health or church growth in the United States, every single one of them is moving in the wrong direction. Doesn't right. matter if it's attendance or baptism or membership or biblical literacy or influence on your community, whatever it is, they're all going in the wrong direction. So to that, we have to ask ourselves, like, what needs to change? What needs to be different? And again, a lot of different places we could go here, but mm-hmm. I think I'm convinced there's multiple paradigm shifts that the existing church in North America needs to experience. There's probably as many as 11 or 12 key paradigm shifts. But I just think this is where we need to start. And I think for me, there's two or three foundational paradigm shifts that help to change everything. And anytime I'm working with a church or with church planters, before we ever talk about like the how, like what is the practicality, what does this look like? I always like to talk about the why. So like, yeah. what are these key theological foundations or these key missiological foundations? And for me, the three key ones for me, let me just say what they are, and then we can dig into this a little bit. And then we could, you know, we could transition and talk about the practical. But for me, the first one is recapturing the missionary nature of the church. I think the church doesn't just send missionaries. The church is the missionary.
Yes.
And there's a whole, you know, almost like a half a day training that I do where we look at the sending language in scripture throughout the Old Testament, the New Testament. And it's absolutely mind-blowing that God is constantly calling men and women out and sending them to participate in his redemptive purposes. So the way I kind of summarize that at the end is to say, if God is a missionary God, and he is, then we as his people are missionary people. So once again, we need to see ourselves as a sent missionary person individually, and we need to see ourselves as sent missionary people collectively. So that's, for me, that's the first foundational paradigm shift, is we need to see ourselves, there's an individual paradigm shift, we need to see ourselves as being sent into our neighborhoods and our workplaces and social spaces, but then collectively, we need to see the church not as a place where certain things happen or not as a vendor of religious goods and services, but instead we need to see ourselves as a sent. We are a gathered and scattered people. We're a called and sent people. So that is an enormous paradigm shift that pushes against this kind of attractional model of church. Yeah. So that's the first one, is recapturing the missionary nature of the church. The other two, very quickly, is what I just call incarnational mission. And this also is an enormous conversation. But I think where that first one is really about missiology, this second paradigm shift is about Christology. In other words, I think we have to recapture a robust Christology that isn't just about the person and work of Christ, but it's about the incarnation. It's about the life and teachings of Jesus. Of course, it's about the cross, but it's also about the resurrection and Pentecost and the ascension and the second coming. And like, there's a robust Christology that needs to inform the way we think about mission. And I think a key piece of that is the incarnation of Jesus. Like, the incarnation should drive us to take responsibility for the places where God has sent us. Mm. So when we really are, when our posture towards our culture or our context is informed by the incarnation, we'll view our neighborhoods differently. We'll view our workplaces differently. So that's the second one, is incarnational mission. And then for me, the third paradigm shift, and all these kind of cohere together, is all participation in the Missio Dei. So that third paradigm shift is all about, it's not really about our strategies. It's not about our human ingenuity, our techniques. It's 100% about God's mission. So we need to discover, what is God already doing, and then discern, how does he want us to participate? So that's why I call it participation in the Missio Dei. You guys know Missio Dei is just a Latin phrase meaning mission of God. So the way these three go together is, we're a sent missionary people, we embed or incarnate our lives in the gospel into the context where God has sent us. And then we become great observers and great listeners to discern what is God already doing? And then how does he want us to participate? So for me, those are three really deep paradigm shifts that have to happen in the church in North America, because I just don't think we think that way typically. So there's just a lot of work there to struggle with these deeply held assumptions we have about church and mission and all of that. And so I like to do all of that before we ever move into the realm of, okay, like practically speaking now, what does this look like?
Yeah.
For those who are listening on the podcast, you cannot see the size of my smile and Michael's smile as we are listening to Brad, and both of us are chomping at the bit excitedly. We're just so thrilled by everything you were saying. So, Michael, I just want to tee you up. What of those three things that he is bringing up, what is most exciting?
Oh, well, all three. I can't. You can't.
I can't take them apart.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Brad, you so beautifully summarized the series that we just completed called Innovative Disruption. And that's what we're talking about. Exactly that. You know, how do we do Jesus-y things or incarnate, especially as the body of Christ, in our places and engage with people? But that, of course, being founded on the idea that, you know, God is at work. I've been using the word, the Latin word, it might be a neologism, but the Latin word omnioperatio. God is always at work. You know, as he's omniscient and omnipresent and omnipotent, he's also omnioperatio. He's always working. And so where is it that he's working? And what does it look like for us to join in that work and incarnate? I mean, we are the body of Christ. And right. If we think about that, not just as a metaphor, but literally, then what does it look like for us to incarnate like Jesus incarnated in culture and engage those cultures? So, yeah, I love that. And I'm 100% on board with this idea that doing it in a co-vocational way is really doing what Jesus did. I mean, he comes into the world not as a religious leader necessarily or somebody coming to plant the church, but he comes as a person and he engages with people with where they are. And what a beautiful model. And certainly something that we see throughout the book of Acts, the same sort of engagement where Paul would go into a place, pick up an occupation as a tent maker, as a philosopher, or whatever it was, and engage people in that way.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because we refer to tent making ministry because Paul probably got paid for it, but when he did philosophy, he didn't, which is very different from today. It's a joke. So I think something that strikes me is that those who are in churches, those who are professionalized in the church world, it's often seen, you know, we all have the quippy phrases, you know, we refer to CEO Christians, you know, Christmas and Easter only. But the reality is so many of us have had a CEO Christian theology, right? That Jesus only exists as the baby who came, and then the man who died, and then we're just going to check out between his birth and his death. We're also not going to highlight so much his resurrection and the ministry that he did before he left. Like there's so much there that we need to mine. And in looking at the incarnation of Christ, it should impact everything. Mm-hmm. It should impact everything that we do. Not just things we're talking about, but how we live, how we love, how we operate as the church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, gosh, there's so many, again, so several different directions we could go with this. I think the ultimate issue there is, you know, in the last few decades, there's been a sense of reductionism around Jesus, and well, I just use the word Christology, where we really reduce Christology down to just the cross. And so, you know, if you ask most evangelicals what comes to mind when you hear Christology, they'll say the cross. And I don't, I'm certainly not minimizing the cross, but we made Christology all about making application of it's really about atonement theories. How am I going to make application to the work of Jesus on the cross to my life individually?
Yes.
Where, yeah, that could still be the center of our Christology, but what about all those other aspects of the life of Jesus? So a lot of times I'll say, you know, most people, when they think of Christology, they think of the person and work of Jesus, but I like to say it's the person, work, and ways of Jesus. So we need the ways of Jesus certainly includes the incarnation, but includes all the life and teachings of Jesus. And I just don't think our missiology or our ecclesiology is informed by the life and teachings of Jesus or the incarnation of Jesus like it should be.
And I'm just going to jump in to say what you just talked about. When Jesus says, repent and believe the good news, he said that while he was on earth, still walking and living, he had not yet died. And so what is he calling people to? What is the good news? I'm not saying it's not the cross. Like I am with you. We are not denigrating, pulling it down, lessening the wonder and significance of Jesus' death. But it's not just that. It is so much more.
Yeah. And I mean, this is such an important area. And we've talked about this often. I mean, if we think about Revelation 14:6, John talks about the gospel as being eternal. And that has to connect to Christ and everything Jesus is, what he did on earth, and who he is right at this very moment. And I wonder if we forget that he is God, and we kind of go our merry way and do our merry things without having that foundation that he is ascended, seated, and he rules even now. Yeah, Brad, this has been great. I put on the shelf earlier a question that I want to bring back, and that is, how does somebody prepare for what you're talking about?
Well, a couple of different ways to go at that, maybe. One is I think first we need to have this conversation about co-vocational ministry much earlier. So, you know, because I alluded to this earlier, what's happening right now is we have a lot of church leaders that were not bivocational or co-vocational, but because maybe the church has shrunk or there's financial pressures that now they have to become bivocational. And that's a much harder thing to do because so many church leaders, they don't have a marketplace skill. You know, they went to Bible college and seminary and it's just hard for them to kind of step out and to look for a 10 hour, 20 hour, maybe even a full-time job in the marketplace. So I think this is a conversation we have to have much earlier on, certainly in collegiate circles. And I would say even in youth groups within our churches, that we need to help those young people in our churches recognize that they don't have to choose, that God can call them to be an architect and they can be deeply engaged in mission and ministry at the same time. So I think that's part of it. I think another part is we need to recapture kind of a robust theology of work. So people recognize that regardless of what God's called them to do in the marketplace, they're in full-time ministry and all work matters. You know, I mentioned earlier that we need to diminish the clergy-laity divide. I think we also need to diminish the sacred-secular divide, especially as it relates to vocation, that some vocations aren't more important than others. And we need to help people in our churches recognize that, you know, help them see how does their calling in the marketplace participate in the Missio Dei? How does it contribute to God's redemptive purposes in the marketplace? And it does. I mean, we've been created for work. Work is good. So let's not bifurcate those things. Let's help people bring them together. And then a real practical thing, Michael, and I know, you know, this is a passion of yours and you've been involved in it for a while, is I think we need to provide theological education in different ways. I think the day is gone when we ask a man or a woman to pull up roots and move to another part of the country to get theological education and then think that they're going to be able to get a full-time job to pay their school debt. And, you know, there's so many things that are wrong with that. So I think for co-vocational leaders, I think some of the content needs to be different, but certainly the way we deliver that content has to be different. So I appreciate, you know, again, what you've been doing for some time now, trying to provide theological education, deliver it in a different way. So those are some of the things. And then we just need to encourage. There's just way too many bivocational and co-vocational leaders that feel like second class pastors, because the people we highlight, the people that speak at conferences, the people who go on stages, you know, are full-time leaders that, you know, grew their church really fast. Instead of highlighting examples of the bivocational, co-vocational, faithful leaders that are in the trenches and they're doing amazing, beautiful, wonderful work, but we just don't do a very good job of telling their story. So I think we all need to do a better job of telling the stories of bivocational and co-vocational leaders, not only to be an encouragement to them, but also I think it can help crack open the imagination of other people, because I'm telling you, there are tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people sitting in our pews and churches all across North America that don't know it's an option. Like when you tell the story of a high school science teacher that's planning a church, they're sitting there saying, I didn't know I could do that. Like, I thought I had to choose. I didn't know I could be a business owner and plan a church. I didn't know I could be a web designer and plan a church. So we need to tell those stories to again, encourage people that are doing it, but also crack open the imagination of people that didn't know it was an option.
That's great.
This is so excellent. If you have been listening to Brad and as we started talking about Christ in your context, right? Exploring why Jesus is good news where you are. And then you've heard us talk about co-vocational and church planting. You're wondering how did these intersect? This was an excellent, excellent ground that we have set. The soil has been tilled because quite a few of the people that we will be talking to in this series are co-vocational pastors, because they are asking the question, what does it look like to actually bring the good news of Jesus to the people where I am, and how can I do that? And Brad, you have no idea how excited I am that we were able to have you on today to hear from you. I'm walking away from this podcast with my mind firing about all the different ways and places that I need to step in to what this could be for me, as well as what it looks like, again, to continue to think through. You know, we're always in ministry. We are always chasing after what God has for us, because he's always working and he's inviting us to us, to this. So Brad, thank you. If people were excited, as I was, by what you brought, where can they interact with you further on some of these things?
Well, I'd say one thing is, so with the group that I work with or work for, there's a page that has a lot of resources, all free. If you just go to covochurchplanting.com, there's a short little video where I kind of describe what co-vocational church planting is all about. And then you can sign up for a monthly webinar. The third Thursday of every month, I do a 50-minute webinar just to dig deeper into the benefits and challenges of being covo. But then also there's some other free resources on that page. There's a book that I wrote about 6 years ago called Co-Vocational Church Planting. You can download a free ebook. That book is in digital form that you can download. There's a link on that page if you go to covochurchplanting.com. I'd also say, if you're interested, or maybe you are bivocational or co-vocational, I started a Facebook group about 5 years ago that's just Co-Vocational Church Planting. So if you're on Facebook, just search Co-Vocational Church Planting. Trust me, it's the only thing that will come up. And right now, there's nearly 2,000 people that are a part of that group. And I would say probably 90% of the people in the group are bivocational or co-vocational. So it's just a great group of just so much expertise and experience that if you have a question, it's just a great place to throw the question out into that group. And you'll just get people jumping in and sharing ideas. And so I would encourage that as well. And then you've already mentioned, Andrew, I try to blog a couple times a week at missionalchurchnetwork.com. So there's a lot of different resources, things we've talked about here, a lot of free stuff that you can download and check out on that site as well.
Cool. Well, Brad, I love what you're doing. I love what you're advocating, and look forward to seeing how the Lord's going to continue that work.
I appreciate it. I always love having this conversation.
We couldn't honored tell. That you brought your wisdom to us today on the podcast. We not just wanting to say thank you to Brad, but to you, our listener. for spending your time with us as well. So if you're interested in finding out more about our Ephesiology podcast, go to ephesiology.com or simply just scroll back in that podcast feed and click on any of the topics that interest you. Also, want to invite you to check out all the resources that we have at masterclasses.ephesiology.com. As Brad hinted at, we are pretty big on online theological education. We want to see what can we perhaps offer you so that you can join in even more with what God is doing in your context. So for Michael, for Brad, and myself, thank you for doing theology and community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.